This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about the FISA Amendments Act of 2008.
That's the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. That's what allows the government to hear all your conversations. And that's what Obama initially, 4.5 years ago, said he would not vote for, but that is what he reauthorized by signing it into law.
We'll talk with Omar Barghouti about the boycott, divest, and sanction movement, as well as his recent talk at Brooklyn College.
As the BDS movement grows, the shrillness of its critics grows as well.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Heidi, over the last year or so, we've covered the incredible spying and surveillance by the New York Police Department on Muslims, Muslim organizations, Muslim restaurants, basically Muslims. Recently, there's been a development, I know, in a case that the Guild is involved in and that you've been following for a long time, the Handschuh case. Can you tell us what is the Handschuh case and what's happening with the Muslim spying now?
Listeners may recall that Handschuh was a lawsuit brought in the 70s on behalf of several activists. The plaintiff was named Barbara Handschuh. It was a class action case. And what came out of it was a consent decree. That's basically a settlement between the police department and the city of New York saying that the police could not spy on political activity or religious activity. Over the years, especially when Ray Kelly came to be the chief of police in New York in 2002, the Handschuh parameters have been greatly limited. What that means is the police basically are back to spying on political activists. But last week, the attorneys for the Handschuh consent decree filed in court alleging that the NYPD's vast spying program on Muslims violates the terms of Handschuh because it's basically spying on religious activity.
It does seem right. I mean, the question is, what's going to happen with it? I mean, I remember I was part of the early Handschuh development in the 70s. And, you know, it was illegal at that point to put up video cameras for demonstrations. They used to have picture books of everybody who went to demonstrations, and we were worried about getting into the bar. And then the Handschuh guidelines at least began to push that back. Then after 9/11, as you said, it reversed itself and they allowed broad political spying. And now we have this.
I think what the lawyers are asking for, one of the things is that there be a special 3-panel review committee, as there used to be a review committee, to go over this type of thing when it happens.
I forgot there was a review committee that required the police to actually go through and justify what they were doing.
Yeah, the police were supposed to keep a paper trail. I mean, there were a lot of us that were very dissatisfied and thought that the victory was a minimal one. But the police were supposed to write down what they were doing and try to justify what they did, and the panel was going to look at that. And that was all thrown over after 9/11.
And so this is really the first case that's taken on the police department spying on Muslims. You know, it went from the movie The Third Jihad to Bloomberg leaving the police commissioner there, even though he participated in The Third Jihad. Massive surveillance of Muslims, so maybe this will actually have an effect.
A photograph on the internet illustrating this story had a picture of David Cohn, who the New York City Police Department recruited from the CIA, who's in charge of intelligence here in New York. So that says a lot. Michael, you've been following this closely. The White House white paper on the use of targeted assassinations has recently been released. Not the Office of Legal Counsel's legal memorandum, that they're keeping a secret. But the white paper talks about who and why the president can decide to assassinate somebody. What's your take on that?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of effort to try and get at the legal standards that the White House is using when it puts together a kill list, which now probably has thousands of people, and when it decides to actually do a killing, whether by drone or by targeted assassination from Joint Special Operations, etc. We failed to get any of the underlying memos. The Center for Constitutional Rights, the ACLU, have had a lawsuit. defending or trying to get those memos through, efforts to stop the killing of Anwar el-Awlaki, who was killed in Yemen eventually. And then, of course, his son was killed. We still represent the al-Awlaki grandfather on behalf of his son and his grandson. But we've been unable to get the standards, and particularly an Office of Legal Counsel memo that explains the standards they use. At the same time, people like Eric Holder have gone on the air and talked about, oh, we are careful here, et cetera. We do it this way and that way. And finally, a couple of days ago, I think in a purposefully leaked memo by the Department of Justice, they leaked a summary of what that Office of Legal Counsel memo said. It's about a 16-page summary of what was a 50-page memo. So it doesn't tell you all the details. And it's called, interestingly, Lawfulness of a Lethal Operation Directed Against the U.S. Citizen Who is a Senior Operational Leader of Al-Qaeda or an Associated Force. A pretty long way of saying how the U.S. is going to justify its assassinations of American citizens overseas. And it has gotten a huge amount of press and a huge amount of flack because the administration had always asserted that they could only target an American citizen or anybody if they were imminently going to attack the United States. In other words, if I had my finger on a button, then I could, in self-defense, kill that guy, supposedly, even though he's outside a war zone. Well, what's interesting and most interesting about this memo is it no longer really says that it has to be imminent in the way that word imminent is traditionally understood. What it says is a, quote, a broader concept of imminence. A broader concept of imminence is saying, essentially, we're going to murder people. Because if it's not imminent that someone is going to launch a missile at you, the U.S., assuming it has a right to even kill them in that circumstance, has absolutely no right if there's no imminence, because there's no argument about self-defense. And what the memo says is the condition that an operational leader present a, quote, imminent threat of violent attack against the United States does not require the U.S. to have clear evidence that a specific attack on the U.S. persons and interests will take place in the immediate future. So what they're saying is the U.S. and Obama there, they can make up this list. They can think that this guy potentially could attack the United States in 5 or 10 years, or he might be a bad guy, et cetera. And then we're going to go launch a drone on this guy or a targeted assassination, and we're going to kill him. So there actually is, to the extent we ever get an uproar about any killings that the U.S. does overseas, there's actually a little bit of a tempest about this now, and particularly the light of Brennan's nomination coming up for the head of the CIA, which runs a lot of these drones, and he's actually in charge of that program.
Well, he's got an office in the basement of the White House. He meets with Obama on Tuesday to decide who should be assassinated. The White House insiders call it Terror Tuesdays. And they have baseball cards with the bios of these people on them, and they go through them and they decide who to take out. Eric Holder has justified all this as affording the victims due process. Michael, talk to us about your understanding of due process as opposed to Eric Holder's.
Well, you know, it's interesting here. The imminent standard, which is one of the standards, even when we were defending trying to stop the killing of Anwar el-Awlaki, cleric in Yemen who was giving very fiery speeches.
The guy that was born in New Mexico.
Right, U.S. citizen. And his son, who was 16 years old, who was killed. And they have never come forward with a justification.
Yeah, born in Colorado.
Never come forward with a justification for killing the 16-year-old. Never. Nothing. He was sitting there with his friends at having some dinner or tea, and they just killed him and five other people or six other people. He apparently had left Sana'a in Yemen to go try and find his father, had been unable to do so, and then he was killed, and then he's coming home, and they kill the son. They've never been able to justify any of those killings. Now, Holder, in his speech a few weeks ago on this issue, a few months ago, said, well, when we talk about American citizens in due process, and I think it's important, and that's the point that I'm trying to make here, the standard they're using to kill American citizens is the same standard they're using to kill everybody else, and none of it's legal or, in my view, at all, this whole imminence thing. That there's an American citizen involved arguably gives that American citizen additional constitutional rights to due process. And we insisted in our cases representing U.S. citizens that they had to take it to a court, get a court to decide on these kinds of issues of imminence.
But not a very radical insistence, Michael. That's been the law for hundreds of years. Due process was always the notion of fairness that goes through the courts, not somebody's executive decision.
And Holder insisted that due process doesn't always mean court process. It could mean the president deciding.
It's a process.
The president deciding on this. So it's a terrible memo, really. It shows the administration, as every other administration in the past, to have been essentially lying to the American people, using a loose standard to kill people, and using broadly, and this is where I think it gets to a broad issue, the same rationale for killing people as the Bush administration used for torturing people. We're in a war on terror. The regular rules don't apply. We can do what we want.
I just wanted to know what you thought about the issue that in many cases where members of Al-Qaeda were killed by drones, they could have actually been captured instead. And does the report address that at all, the rationale for that?
Well, the report tries to say that these are in situations where it's not feasible to capture the person. But it's interesting. I think that's a really good point you're making, because the criteria are not just imminence, but are that basically it's impossible for capture. And the report skates all around that. Part of it is they argue that, well, too many American troops will be killed if we try and do this. They're actually watering down the impossible to capture standard. You have to have imminence, impossible to capture, and you also have to have the plot to attack the U.S. has to be specific and concrete. There's a whole bunch of criteria that go with this, assuming you even accept a paradigm that they can be killing people in Yemen outside of a war zone or in Somalia. Assuming you accept that, it has these criteria, including the one you're referring to, impossible to capture, and they have obviously watered that down completely. Also, impossible to capture when? At that particular moment, or 2 weeks later, or 4 weeks later? So it's a crushingly awful legal standard by which they're killing both American citizens and others around the world, in addition to all the other factors. It's making enemies for us and all of that.
You know, I think we can't underline strongly enough the continuity between the Democratic Obama-Holder administration and the Republican Bush-Cheney administration. Bush-Cheney said the whole world's a battlefield. The commander-in-chief, therefore, is in charge. You can't question him. We can put people in cages for years. They can't get out. Indefinite detention. We can put them on an island prison. We can render them. That rationale is the same rationale that Obama and Holder are using. And now they're saying not only can we put them away forever, but we can also assassinate them. It's total continuity.
Days before 2012 drew to a close, the U.S. Senate voted 73-23 to reauthorize the FISA amendments of 2008 for an additional 5 years. FISA is a spying bill that violates the Fourth Amendment and gives vast unmonitored authority to the National Security Agency to conduct dragnet surveillance of Americans' international emails and phone calls. We're joined today by Michelle Richardson, legislative counsel with the ACLU Washington Legislative Office. Michelle focuses on national security and government transparency issues. Her article, Warrantless Wiretapping Wins Again, points out that there was broad support in the Senate for making the FISA Amendments Act more transparent. Welcome, Michelle, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
So we've started 2013 with reauthorization of FISA Amendments Act. And we wanted to first start by asking you what some of the recommendations for adding transparency requirements were.
Yes, the Senate took up the FISA reauthorization bill right at the end of the year, and they did consider a handful of very moderate amendments that that wouldn't have actually interfered with the collection of information, but made it more transparent to Congress and the public so that we can make a more informed decision about its effect on privacy. So, for example, Senator Merkley had an amendment that would have required the administration to find a way to make the secret FISA court opinions public. We now know that there are significant secret court opinions that talk about the Constitution and our rights, and those should not remain secret. In an open and free democracy, there should be no secret law. Another example is an amendment by Senator Wyden, who has been the leader on these issues over the last few years. And he simply wanted basic information about how many Americans have been picked up in the spying program and what is done with their information. You know, can the government repurpose it and use it for other things? Can they search through all of this data looking for specific Americans? And sadly, both of those amendments failed.
Michelle, I want to go back a little bit. I'm not as current as I used to be. Of course, I was around at 9/11, and I remember when they made the first set of FISA amendments that Bush made to try and get more information through wiretapping, obviously. But then there was also the secret program, the warrantless wire program, that they didn't go to Congress for. Then it got approved by Congress 4 years ago, I guess, when Obama was still senator, and after saying he would vote against it, he voted for it. And then there was the ACLU lawsuit, which was argued in the Supreme Court, I think based on the original warrantless wiretapping. But bring us up to date. Why are we so concerned by this? What are the big changes that took place over the last, 30 years since the first act in the 70s?
Well, the original FISA was much more targeted, and it required a traditional probable cause finding and an individualized warrant before you could go up and tap a phone number and nowadays an email address. But after 9/11, Congress and the administrations started systematically lowering the standard for obtaining this information. They made it easier to go around a court. So it would be done administratively. They lowered the standard so that there was no longer a probable cause or a usual Fourth Amendment finding, and continue to do these programs in secret so there would be no oversight. The FISA Amendments Act, though, is probably one of the biggest changes over the last decade, and it went into FISA and said, okay, you no longer have to name who you're going to tap or the phone number or state of facility. Instead, we're going to just do these programmatic orders so the court is no longer involved in deciding who will be tapped, and we'll leave that up to the administration as long as they promise they're not going to tap any specific person in the United States on purpose.
Okay, I'm not sure I understand. There's the secret court, and now they can just go in and say we want to tap a general category of people, but what happens to people in the United States? I didn't follow that.
Well, yes. Instead of going in now and saying, I want to wiretap John Smith, they say, I'm not going to target any specific American, but I would like information about Al-Qaeda or information about Yemen or some other place that is a hotbed of terrorism or somehow related to foreign affairs in some way. And the court will then give them a year-long order that allows them to choose who to wiretap, what to get, and how to use the information without ever coming back to the court and explaining who was actually caught up in the wiretaps.
That's completely mouth-dropping. I've studied this. I had no idea that was what it allowed, that they don't even have to name the people.
Right. And theoretically, this isn't intentionally turned inwards to the United States at any specific person. And if that situation arises, they go back and get a real court order. But we think that it's just being used for bulk collection. They grab everything they can. In that process, millions of Americans are being swept up. And the fact that they aren't intentionally being suspected of anything or tapped really doesn't matter for their constitutional rights. They're still being swept up into these programs, and the government has their information.
Given what we know about AT&T's equipment center due to technician Mark Klein's disclosures, it seems to me that a lot of these laws like FISA reauthorization really is just a formality for a sea change in how the government is capturing data as we've shifted really to a cyber world. Do you think that's going too far?
I think that's a perfect way to describe it. The old days of tracking down bad guys who you think have done something wrong are gone. And now the government uses its incredible authorities and computing power to just collect everything in the hopes that someday they'll come up with a computer system that will, quote-unquote, connect the dots or show them where the terrorists are. But these programs never work, and there's no belief that these programs are actually catching terrorists or spies like they are supposed to.
Attorney Michelle Richardson from the ACLU, let me ask you, should I be concerned? I really don't make overseas phone calls, except for like once a year when I call my cousin in Budapest. I pretty much stay close to home. So am I going to be swept up in this?
It's likely yes, for a couple of reasons. One is you are probably making international communications without realizing it. And the way the internet works now, sometimes your communications will travel around the world before landing next door. And so in those situations, you may be making a purely domestic communication, but it will be caught up anyways. But the bigger problem is that the administration keeps hedging, and the law certainly says on its face, that the bulk collection is okay, as long as no specific American is intentionally targeted. And that could only be drafted so that you are, you know, accidentally or incidentally picked up in those sorts of programs.
The problem I see is that information now is stored for an indeterminate period of time, so that 5 years from now, for example, NSA or another government agency could go back and extract that information that Michael was swept up in without his knowledge. Also, equipment is being manufactured to allow back doors for governments to have direct access to communications equipment.
Yes. That is correct. The way we understand it is that a lot of times the technology is built so the government can directly tap into the system, and that so they don't even need to go on a case-by-case to the company and request the information. They can just access it themselves, and this is a huge concern about whether that's being smartly and lawfully used. And it does leave to bulk collection programs and the storage of mass data, like you mentioned. You know, some of this information can probably be kept indefinitely, and now that they're building out facilities like the ones in Utah that can hold data that we don't even have words to describe yet because it's so big and includes so much, that we're all going to end up in there eventually. And they're eventually going to have enough information that it is going to reveal something private and personal, even if not illegal.
I want to go back for a second to this question of applying for authority to wiretap a subject such as Guantanamo or WikiLeaks or whatever, or Al-Qaeda, and the fact that they can do that just so they aren't intentionally targeting an American. I can't even begin to understand that because, for example, the center and myself represent Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. They say, of course, we're attorneys, so that's a separate sort of question. But they simply go to the court and they say, we want to get a broad-based warrant or whatever they call it there to get information about WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. And, of course, they're going to pick up everybody who's emailing Julian Assange and WikiLeaks and everybody who's talking to them. But they're not necessarily looking for what Michael Ratner is saying, but they're looking for everything about WikiLeaks. And it's never going to necessarily focus on me because I'm not necessarily doing anything that's illegal or anything. I'm going to be part of the whole mess of stuff they just gather in. Leave aside the attorney-client part for a second. They can just go on forever with that. It just seems like a completely open door to wiretapping Americans. Is there something I'm missing here?
No, you're not. And while we often talk about FISA as a tool to catch terrorists and spies, it's actually just for, quote-unquote, foreign intelligence, which includes undefined terms like the national defense of the United States or information that would affect the foreign affairs of the United States. So it's an incredibly broad category that can be used all over the world for different issues to collect lots of different information. And you're talking not just phone calls, but texts and emails and internet records that when combined together under the NSA's very powerful computers can reveal some very intensely personal information.
Michelle, a few years ago, didn't the ACLU bring a lawsuit on behalf of several organizations, including, I believe, attorneys who had reason to suspect that their conversations were being monitored. I think the case was dismissed on grounds that they couldn't prove that it had been.
There were two cases. We originally challenged the George Bush warrantless wiretapping program,
right.
And that was dismissed. But when the president signed the FISA Amendments Act in 2008, we also challenged that law. And that case is still alive. Our litigators just argued before the Supreme Court in October on that case. However, it's at the very initial stages, and they're still debating standing and whether these attorneys and journalists and activists who are doing work in the Middle East and in these other areas that are probably targeted for wiretapping can allege that there's a harm done to them. And, you know, they have very compelling stories about not being able to communicate with their sources or their clients out of fear that their communications are being swept up in these FISA programs.
It has a chilling effect on First Amendment protected activities.
That's correct. And you can look at the statements by the plaintiffs in this case, and they say, well, either I just don't have the communication, or instead of being able to communicate like a normal modern American through email and phone, you know, I have to fly overseas and then do these things in person,
right.
Which is not always the most time-effective or appropriate way to actually deal with a situation.
And so, it's costly, too.
Very costly, yes. We believe they absolutely have been harmed by this program, and their belief that they are being picked up in this has a chilling effect. That's enough to move the case forward. We hope that once we win at the Supreme Court, we'll get to the merits, but we know it's a long road and there'll probably be several years and debates around state secrets and other issues, too, in the meantime.
Michelle Richardson, it's really been a pleasure to speak with you, but I have a question, and Michael had one too. Mine is kind of looking back over the last decade or so. You've been active with the American Civil Liberties Union, and before that with Congressman Conyers on these privacy issues. We've been doing this show for about 7 or 8 years, and we're coming to the conclusion here that we're in a brave new world, that things are totally different than they were before 9/11. And how do you see things looking back, how they have evolved?
Well, I have a colleague who calls it the one-way ratchet, where, you know, we never pull these things back. We only move in one direction, and that's towards more surveillance. I think there is reason to believe, though, that this is a self-correcting situation and that people will start looking at this technology and understand more about what's actually out there and how intensely personal it is and demand that more privacy protections be put in so that companies and the government can't use that information against them. But, you know, it's important to remember that the first, you know, at 9/11, there was no Facebook or smartphones, and this is all incredibly new technology, and there's still a lot of education to be done so people understand how it's really impacting their lives.
I'm just interested, you know, I looked at this book called Cypherpunks, which maybe you've seen. It's a Julian Assange book, but one of the assertions that he makes in the book is that they no longer, and the governments no longer have to really look to go after individuals and surveil individuals, but they can, it's easier and cheaper to do mass surveillance and then look at the information later. And sort of what the way the FISA court seems to be going is a little bit in that direction. But his assertion is that the machines are so cheap now for taking in all the information that you can attach one on, like for the computers in Colombia or the phone calls, and for $30 million you can download every single thing that goes through it. And so why bother with warrants and all that? Let's just take everything and look at it later, even though it might be illegal in the United States. So I'm interested in your thought about that. And then just for our audience, a little more about Utah and what they're storing there and what's going on in Utah.
Yeah. So to your first question, I think that analysis is exactly correct. Because these programs are so secret, we're really just going off of the occasional leak to the New York Times or a statement from a senator. But that is what we believe is going on, that they're just collecting everything to somehow process later. And we are worried that that is something that the FISA court has accepted as acceptable under the Fourth Amendment. But we won't know until those court opinions come out. We understand from public statements that the court has ruled that some things the government has done is unconstitutional and other things aren't. And we need that information. As far as Utah specifically, we understand the NSA has built this huge new facility in Utah that's capable of storing massive amounts of data to literally copy the internet if they wanted to many, many times over and store that data. So while we've talked for years about this dystopian future of the government collecting all this information, you know, it was always at least limited by the technology of that being impractical. And now it looks like as we move forward, this really is going to become a reality, and they are going to actually have the technology and the ability to collect this information.
Michelle, this has been eye-opening for us on many fronts, and we would love to have you back on in a few months to talk about the state of cyber spying.
Absolutely. It'd be my pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Michelle, for being on Law & Disorder.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
A huge free speech academic freedom battle erupted after the announcement of a student group at CUNY's Brooklyn College, Students for Justice in Palestine, along with the sponsorship of the college's political science department, will host two speakers who will discuss their views on the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement. The BDS movement, as many listeners may know, calls for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel in protest of the government's oppressive policies towards the Palestinian people. The speakers are Palestinian BDS advocate Omar Barghouti and University of California, Berkeley philosopher and BDS supporter Judith Butler. The backlash included a threat by New York City Council members to defund Brooklyn College and a letter written by all three candidates for New York City mayor, the leading congressman Gerald Nadler, and others, urging that the panel also include opponents of the boycott. Harvard Law Professor Alan Dershowitz, best known for his success in getting Norman Finkelstein fired from a university in Chicago and for advocating the use of torture warrants, called the event a propaganda hate orgy, and a major New York Daily newspaper labeled it Israel bashing. We're joined today by Omar Barghouti, the founding member of the Palestinian Campaign for Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel and the Palestinian Civil Society Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, BDS, campaign.
He's also the author of the book BDS, The Global Struggle for Palestinian Rights. We talk about the details of the backlash and the BDS movement going forward. Omar Barghouti, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Well, Omar, I have to say that you didn't come quietly into New York City. There's been a huge public fight over allowing you to speak unobstructed at Brooklyn College. The characterizations of BDS have been fantastic. Tell our audience, what is BDS?
Okay. BDS is a global movement with a Palestinian anchor, a Palestinian guiding group that was established around the BDS call, the call for a boycott, divestment, and sanctions of Israel that came out from Palestinian civil society in 2005. Specifically, the BDS call said that Israel and institutions and corporations that are complicit in Israel's violations of international law should be boycotted, divested from, and eventually sanctioned in order to achieve the three basic rights of the Palestinian people under international law: ending the occupation of 1967, which includes the illegal colonies, the wall, and so on; ending the system of racial discrimination within Israel itself, which meets the UN definition of apartheid, and I can expand on that later; and the third is the right of return for refugees, which is their basic inalienable right under international law. So in order to achieve these three basic rights of the three main segments of the Palestinian people, we absolutely need international solidarity, as was done in the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. We cannot do it alone. And it's not just something outstandingly heroic that we're asking people to do. It's actually a basic moral obligation and complicity in crimes committed against us. Your tax money is funding Israel's occupation and apartheid. You have an obligation to question where your money is going to and how it's being used to oppress us.
I have a question for you. We interviewed you a year ago or so about your book on BDS, which is, I think, a critical book for people to read. But in the years since then, has the BDS movement grown? Has it been more under attack? Are the attacks that went against you at Brooklyn College representative of a pushback? What's going on?
I think just the fact that the New York Times editorial supported having a debate on BDS at Brooklyn College says it all. We could have never imagined such a thing a year ago, in fact. So yes, within this last year, many key figures have come out in support of BDS. Unions around the world have supported it. The government of South Africa's ruling party, the ANC, endorsed BDS December of last year, just weeks ago. Major artists, writers, filmmakers, many Jewish groups have joined BDS campaigns and are leading BDS campaigns. In fact, this is all terrifying the Zionist establishment, the Israel lobby in this country. They're absolutely hysterical about it. Thus, the vilification, the intimidation, the bullying, even the New York Times called it bullying and intimidation, that they're using against human rights activists like us.
Tell us a bit about that bullying. Over the past year, if you've spoken at academic institutions or elsewhere, what kind of response have you gotten from critics?
Well, bullying is one thing and response from critics is another. We're very open to debate. In fact, we welcome debate, but no one would debate us. I had an interview at Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, and they called many, many, many people, assemblymen, congresspeople, politicians in New York who attacked the Brooklyn College event, attacked BDS, and vilified BDS. None of them agreed to debate us. I mean, that says a lot. They're running scared of debate, and we're begging for debate because we want to explain what we're doing. In most places, the reaction has been civil. Whether people agree or disagree, they ask, they argue, they debate in a civil way. With the exception of Brooklyn College, a very uncivilized reaction, rabid, extremely hateful reaction and vilification, in general, the response has been really excellent. I can give an example. Last year, I spoke at Brandeis College, and it wasn't easy. There was intense debate, but it was a very civil debate. Despite some threats from some fanatics there, nothing materialized. Everything went on schedule and very well.
Were you on a panel at Brandeis or just you spoke?
No, I was invited by the Students for Justice in Palestine, which is almost entirely a Jewish group at Brandeis. And in fact, the head of the SJP at Brandeis is Israeli, a Jewish Israeli. So it was, everyone was Jewish, basically, in that room, those for, those against BDS. So the anti-Semitism charge did not work very well.
What's interesting about that and Brooklyn College is, I mean, one of the I mean, there was all the really nasty stuff about BDS. But one of the objections that had this ring of free speech about it was, well, it has Judy Butler and Omar Barghouti both talking about BDS, but it doesn't have anybody who is, like, deadly opposed to BDS, and therefore it's not balanced. And that has a ring to it that, oh, well, we have to balance these things. What was your response to that?
Not every event, every talk has to be balanced. The balance is overall. So if you only, if a college sponsors events that support one point of view and never allows the opposing point of view, then there's imbalance. But not every single event has to be balanced. If you have a panel on gay rights, let's say, and you invite three different people with varying opinions, but they all support gay rights, would that be accused of being imbalanced? You have to have a bigot to say gays do not deserve equal rights in order to balance this panel? No. But I mean, if people can get their views aired in other panels that do have different opinions, that's fine. And those accused using this panel of being imbalanced themselves, like Dershowitz, always speak solo, by themselves, unopposed, and espousing the most extreme ideas like torture, a war crime, without any opposition, including at Brooklyn College. So what are they talking about? Academic freedom is not about balance in every single event. It's an overall balance that all views have to be aired.
I thought Glenn Greenwald particularly wrote about Dershowitz speaking a lot alone, and he just demolished the argument that you have to have balance in every event. And when you talked about Brandeis, I remember I was at Brandeis in the late 60s and mid-60s, and they brought Malcolm X to speak at Brandeis. He just spoke alone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was a young 1965. I thought this guy was, like, you know, incredible, but I also was critical of some of the things. It was the first time I'd ever heard of it. But there was no idea that they would have to put someone else on the panel with Malcolm X to disabuse people of whatever they wanted on Malcolm X. So you're right. I mean, I think it was all used as an excuse to get at BDS, really.
And they're twisting the very definition of academic freedom, which some right-wing pundits in this country often do. They twist definitions according to their own agenda, to fit their own agenda. They ignore totally international law. It sounds like a foreign language, international law, in this country.
They're accusing you of trying to delegitimize the state of Israel, and they're accusing you of making the two-state solution impossible. How do you respond to those accusations?
You know, human rights are tough sometimes. If you have a master-slave type of oppressive relationship and the slave insists on freedom and nothing less than freedom, that upsets the order. That kind of undermines the system and the peaceful order that you have, like you had in the southern states in this country. But what is it about delegitimization that whenever this issue about Palestinian rights comes up, we hear delegitimizing Israel? Did equality in Alabama delegitimize whites, delegitimize Southerners? It delegitimized apartheid in the South. We did not call it apartheid then. But according to the UN Convention, which passed in 1973, that would have been an apartheid system. You have two-tiered legal system. That's apartheid. So the same with Israel. We're delegitimizing Israel's occupation, apartheid, and denial of Palestinian rights. We're insisting on our rights. We're not delegitimizing any people. We're delegitimizing an order that's illegitimate by definition. Apartheid is illegal. Occupation is illegal. Building colonies on occupied territory is illegal. Ethnic cleansing is illegal. That's what we're delegitimizing.
What about the second part of my question about making a two-state solution impossible? Do you believe that you're doing that, or do you believe that it's no longer possible given the expanse of the settlements?
You know, with my other hat as a political analyst and a human rights activist, I may answer that. But as a BDS representative, I have to explain. The BDS movement is extremely consistent about being neutral on the one-state versus two-states solution. And this is not a simple, pragmatic decision that we took. Since BDS was established in 2005, we took an absolutely neutral position on one state, two states for several reasons. First, we insist that human rights are not negotiable. We deserve our basic rights under international law, regardless whether it's a one state, two state solution, five state solution. People have a right to end the occupation, to end racial discrimination, and to return to their homes of origin from which they were ethnically cleansed, regardless what the solution might be. The second point is very simple. The BDS National Committee which is the BNC, which is the leadership of the global BDS movement, comprises every main civil society group, union, network in Palestine and among Palestinians in exile. And we have absolutely no consensus among those groups in this big coalition called the BDS National Committee on one state versus two states. In fact, if you polled most of the groups within the BDS National Committee, they would support two states.
Can you give us a few specific examples of boycott or divest efforts that are underway and are gaining momentum?
Of course. In the United States in particular, there's a huge BDS campaign that was initiated by Jewish Voice for Peace, but now is also led by the Quaker groups, Adala New York, which is a local BDS group, and many other groups within that coalition, the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. It targets TIAA CREF, the major pension fund, trying to convince it to sell off its stock in companies that are profiting from Israel's occupation. And they're targeting specific companies like Caterpillar, HP, Veolia, Elbit, and so on. It's not a blanket boycott against every company that's complicit, because that doesn't work. BDS is about context sensitivity, graduality, and sustainability. So you've got to address the most sinister companies, as it were, the most seriously involved in human rights violations, and move towards others, to teach others a lesson, basically. There's a campaign by the anti-war movement Code Pink against Ahava, which is a cosmetics company that manufactures in the occupied Palestinian territory. There's a big campaign now against SodaStream, led by an interfaith coalition, because SodaStream is manufactured in an illegal colonial settlement in the occupied territories. And there's a campaign against Veolia, the transport water management company, because it's involved in the Jerusalem Light Rail, which is a tram connecting Israel's illegal colonies with the city of Jerusalem. And it's winning a lot of contracts in this country. But Veolia, just to explain to the listeners, since we started targeting it in November 2008 until now, lost more than $16 billion, with a B, $16 billion worth of contracts, mainly due to BDS activism in the UK, in Ireland, in Sweden, and elsewhere.
That's wonderful.
I have a question about the thing that gets most controversial, which in some way I hate to go to because there's so much else on BDS, but you always hear it, is the sort of cultural academic BDS position on all of that. And then I was thinking, and I don't know if it's relevant to this, but I think the movie Five Broken Cameras, which is a very good movie about Berlin, but in fact had some work done on it by a group called The Greenhouse, I'm not sure, that was Palestinian as well as Israeli filmmakers, and just how you look at that part of the boycott.
Okay, I think you're right to ask about this. I mean, this is a very important question. The cultural and academic boycott part of BDS is the least understood, especially in this country. Many people think that we're blacklisting academics or artists or something of that sort. Let me just explain. The Palestinian campaign for the academic and cultural boycott of Israel has never and will never call for an individual boycott. It calls for institutional boycotts, because people have in mind the South African academic boycott, which targeted every single academic. It was a blanket boycott, in fact, but people forget that. The Palestinian campaign, it's much more targeted, much more nuanced. We do not target individual academics. We target the institutions, cultural academic institutions. Now, if we're talking about an Israeli project, let's say an arts project in Israel, a film, an Israeli filmmaker as a taxpayer is entitled to take money from foundations, including public foundations in Israel, so long as there are no political strings attached. And I'll tell you more about the political strings issue. But he or she is entitled to get this money, and we do not target his or her film just based on the fact that they receive money from the Israeli state, because that's their entitlement. When there's a Palestinian involved, that brings in a whole new concept of what we call normalization. Normalization basically makes an abnormal relationship between oppressor and oppressed look deceivingly normal. And this is unacceptable. As one Palestinian activist coined the term, we need co-resistance, not coexistence, until we end oppression. So the only normal relationship, if you will, between Palestinians and Israelis is co-resistance kind of relationship against the occupation and apartheid. Not coexistence despite oppression, because that would institutionalize and prolong the oppression. So cultural and academic boycott target institutions. The one caveat that I promised to get back to is the contract. Thanks to a progressive Israeli Jewish writer who wrote in Haaretz, we now know there's a contract that the Israeli Foreign Ministry makes Israeli artists, academics, poets, writers sign in order to get Foreign Ministry money in order to tour, to go to conferences and festivals and screenings internationally and so on. This contract basically has two main clauses that says you shall not undermine the policies of the State of Israel and you shall do your best to put in Israel in a positive light. Immediately upon discovering about this contract, PACBI, the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, said any artist, any academic, any intellectual who agrees to sign this contract is automatically forfeiting any claim to academic freedom, cultural freedom to express themselves, because they've signed a contract that says they are ambassadors of the State of Israel, and they shall be treated accordingly. Their films, their products would be boycotted because they've accepted conditional, politically conditioned money to represent the State of Israel and whitewash Israeli occupation and apartheid.
Omar, if our listeners want to follow your political work and try to help out, do you have a website or somewhere you could direct people to?
Sure. The BDS Movement's website is www.bdsmovement.net. So that's easy. The academic and cultural boycott aspect of BDS, which is one of the pillars of BDS, is pacbi.org, P-A-C-B-I.org. One of our key Israeli partners, the Coalition of Women for Peace, produces an excellent website called WhoProfits.org, one word, WhoProfits.org, which is a database of companies, very well-researched database, of companies, Israeli or international, that are involved and profiting from Israel's occupation. So that's an excellent resource. In this country, people can join the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, which is a huge coalition of about 400 groups working on Palestinian rights, including on BDS, Jewish Voice for Peace, Adala New York here in New York, AFSC, the American Friends Service Committee, and many, many other groups that are doing excellent work in this country on BDS.
We will link to our website, lawanddisorder.org, on those groups you just mentioned. What do you think will come out of last week's events? What did you want to emphasize?
Well, throughout this tour that I'm doing in the United States, including the Brooklyn College event, the main goal is to explain to American audiences, as wide as possible, the BDS movement, the human rights aspects of the BDS movement. It's a vilified, misunderstood, misrepresented movement in this country. Dissent and even in any argument against Israeli policies is almost becoming illegitimate in this country. And this is kind of a new McCarthyism that we're challenging. It's absolutely a new form of McCarthyism that Israel's lobby is leading in this country, shutting down any dissent regarding Israel. Even inside Israel, in the Israeli parliament, you get much more debate on Israeli policies than you get in the U.S. Congress. For one simple reason, in the Knesset, besides Likud, you have other parties. In Congress, you only have Likud.
No, it's very true. I think you could also make the point that because of the absolute identity and no space between American politicians and Likud, the bad practices in Israel are now spilling over the Atlantic Ocean here on us, so that you have this attempt to violate free speech and academic freedom at Brooklyn College, which is just outrageous. But because of American support for Israel, there's a blowback here crushing our rights.
Absolutely. And there's another aspect to this responsibility issue, that American citizens indeed have a responsibility to stand up to how their tax money is being used in human rights violations around the world, including in Palestine, but also Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Yemen, and so on. Use of the drones and other massive international law violations that the U.S. is committing. In Palestine, it's certainly the most extreme case of U.S. complicity, U.S. official complicity in violations of international law and human rights through the billions and billions of dollars that Israel receives from the U.S. and the protection that Israel receives at the United Nations in every international forum from the U.S. government in order to keep it on a pedestal, so to speak, as Archbishop Desmond Tutu once said. Israel is put on a pedestal above international law. It shall not be questioned or held accountable to international law thanks to the U.S. and thanks to U.S. tax money. That's why freedom of expression here, freedom of debate here about money going to Israel, about Israeli policies, is essential. It's a requirement to go forth.
Well, Omar, we really admire your being here. You're participating in the debate in Brooklyn College, and your really wonderful book. Give us the name of the book again, because we've pushed it for a year or two, but it's really important. What is it?
The book is called Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions, BDS, The Global Struggle for Palestinian Rights. It was published by Haymarket in 2011, and now it's in its second edition. We hope soon we'll issue the third edition.
Well, congratulations, and you are really one of the best, maybe the best, explainer of BDS of people that I know. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Omar.
Omar, thanks so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Suffer. Oh no, I won't be the one.